Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org.
I'm Chris Higashi, the program manager for the Washington Center for the Book here at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to tonight's event with Robin Becker, Barbara Hamby, and Alicia Ostreicher. First, thank you, of course, to the Pitt Poetry Series for making this possible. We thank the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Robin Becker, Tiger Heron. So Robin's the author of 7 poetry collections and this brand new book, Tiger Heron. No offense to the rest of you, but my cat Molly showed a very clear preference for your book. If you looked at my book, you would see bite marks in the corner. And every time she came near it on my nightstand, maybe it's the heron on the cover. So here's what the late Maxine Kumin said. Becker's Tiger Heron, rich with animal life, from the flying squirrel and prairie dog to inhabitants of the coral reefs of the Caribbean, expresses outrage and grief over the ongoing destruction of these ecosystems. A moving poem deals with homophobia. Another celebrates Yiddish, a mongrel, middle-high German. These vivid, self-confident lyrics, ranging from villanelle to couplet, deserve close reading. Robin?
Thank you, Chris. This poem is for Barbara. It's called Old Florida. When the soon-to-be-famous hurricane hurried to their neighborhood, I begged them to leave. Rain made a cassoulet of the parking lot. Winds juggled giant palms like rolling pins. Shy herons took cover beneath awnings and stood like museum guards in doorways. But my parents hunkered down. Children under desks in the 50s, the storm their personal blitz. I cried, I screamed over the phone, but they rejected the generator-backed shelter I found, chose canned goods and bunker until the phone died, and I consigned them to their neighbors, their luck, their blood thinners. 87 years old, they hid on the 9th floor. Elevator out, infrastructure crumbling. But more than death or thirst, they feared their daughter with her talk of evacuation. Leaving home, even for natural disaster, made them refugees. Registrants in a vast and subtly documented conspiracy to remove them from their apartment to assisted living. Neighbors found them sweating in their foxhole, ferried batteries, salami, and ice. And when the power came back, they phoned to report that hardship brought out the kindness in people. Wasn't it fortunate they stayed in their home? And where was my faith in human goodness? So speaking of human goodness, I'll read 2 poems about animal rescue. This is called Rescue Parable. Though saved from starvation and given his own name, bowl, bed, though he wears the tags of ownership and veterinary care, though he sleeps in the sun with his cat, who grooms him in the autumn afternoon, he carries every bone to the back of the yard, digs with his forepaws a grave, and with his nose, dutiful as one enslaved, covers with dirt the coming poverty. And this is the companion poem to that called Rescue Riddle. When she takes her morning tea, he settles beside her, body of law and praise, Procurus, his winter and summer hearth. Each day to work, she turns her back on his slim muzzle, narrow rib cage, small paws braced.
She might have left him to starve with his brothers years ago on that beach in Mexico, one leave-taking instead of the thousands ahead of them. When you look at the spines of your books for Amy Lang, when you look at the spines of your books arrayed around the rooms, you know who you are. As the diver knows herself by the molecules of air and water she displaces, carving her torso into form. The typefaces and shiny patinas where your fingers rubbed the titles. The classrooms, the students, the decades of civil strife. Here, demonstrators still chant and march. Arguments take shape, and you draft a proposal. You protest in Washington. When you look at the spines of your books, you know the arduous training of the mind for clarity and compassion. You are Buddhist and Hindu, Arab and Jew, forever having to learn the other, shared climate and human history of settlement, where alluvial sediment preserved the striped clay fragments of a flute. And the ethnographer recorded that everyone for 500 miles knew the harmonies. When my parents died, I realized that I lost the sound in my ear of the Yiddish they would speak to each other. And that was a loss that I reflected on and wrote this poem called The Sounds of Yiddish. The sounds of Yiddish splat like matzah broken and dropped in the egg milk mix for matzah brei. They knock you deep in the kishkes. They smart Kinahara with the shtick of the canny mensch who knows schlock when she sees it. You think I'm a pisher? Don't drain mir cup. Yiddish knows an example is not proof. Gives the tumbler with a pisk the barbed shrug. When a schlamazel sells an umbrella, the sun comes out. You should grow like an onion with your head in the ground. Yiddish hisses with chicken schmaltz sizzling for knishes. Not invited to the luncheon? Don't worry, her knedlach don't float. Like the Sami with many words for snow, we have many for fool. Shtunk, schlepper, schlemiel, schmuck. Hear that rumbling across the Ukraine? Yiddish ran from a posse of hazards when my bubby left her shtetl. Russians at her back and a mongrel middle-high German in her mouth. A language is a dialect with an army and a navy, the saying goes. To which my peasant relatives reply, spare us what we can learn to endure. Dyke. The word came after me, then hid each time I turned to look at it. It breathed in the hedge. I could hear it bite and snap the air. I feared the woman with slick-backed hair sitting on a bar stool, her back to the dance floor, a beer in her hands. Disco drove the word away, but it came back. Bulldike, bulldagger. What did the word want with me? And why this dread, this desire, this dangerous butch striding through Kenmore Square uncamouflaged? Dyke had a spike in it, a cleated surge. In leathers, the word leapt 18th century grillwork on the Boston Common and led the parade around the city, the slow, snaking, joyful motorcade of a new millennium. First, I had to hate her. Then I had to hurt her. The rest of my life, I ate from her hand. I'll read two more poems. In Pennsylvania, where I live, the Civil War reenactors enjoy coming and setting up their encampments all around the state, and I happen to live in the town that houses the Pennsylvania Military Museum. So this poem that I'll read next is based on an encounter I had with the Civil War reenactors. It's called The Civil War Comes to Town. What could I say to the 128th Pennsylvania Infantry Regiment reenactor, pouring coffee by the company sea fire with his sons? Have some bacon, he offered. Gesturing to the iron pot, blackened by the 1863 campaigns, Chancellorsville and Wapping Heights, Auburn Mills and Kelly's Ford. We followed behind after father, one costumed boy offered. Then he ran off with his wooden rifle to shoot his brother. My dog lay down in the sun. Now we've got a company mutt, one blue-suited soldier said. I stood by the chessboard, watching the soldiers mull over their moves. We mustered in August of 1862, my reenactor told me. Coffee? They offered me a seat at the writing table, where a recruit struggled with a letter to Poe River, Virginia, May 10th, 1864. Inside the tent, someone hemmed a coat, pulling the needle through coarse blue wool. Young men rubbed Hubert's shoe grease on brogans, and soon I fell to mending blankets. I stuffed my hair into a cap and took the role of Rob, cross-dressing scout who saved 300 souls. Thus, I joined the men of Company C. We nursed our sick without women or running water. Bayonets ready, we entered the enemy's tents. Thank you. The dog I didn't want. The dog I didn't want ran in anxious circles around the room, stacked crates of dogs in need of homes. I drifted toward a puppy, nonchalant. The assistant said he hadn't yet been fixed, and returned the dog I didn't want to his cage. An older couple looking to assuage a recent loss sat with a spaniel transfixed. The dog I didn't want yipped and cried in his metal pen. Take him for a walk, the keeper called, gave me a leash. Outside, he stalked the mailbox post and tugged to come inside. He wouldn't meet my gaze or lick my hand or charm with any doggy gifts. Instead, the dog I didn't want curled up and tucked his head into the coiled spiral of his body, color of sand. Quiet, eyes closed, snout down. He awaited his fate like one bound for the gallows or the chair. Resigned, unloved, the dog I didn't want, in his despair, won me his small estate. Thank you.
I think that might be one of my favorite poems in the book. All right, since I screwed up my own format. Sorry. Barbara Hamby, On the Street of Divine Love, New and Selected Poems. Barbara Hamby is the author of four poetry collections and an award-winning book of linked stories. She also co-edited an anthology of poetry, Seriously Funny, with her husband, David Kirby. I do have to say, we fell in love with David years ago, David and his poetry, when we brought him to Seattle. So, On the Street of Divine Love is a collection of 25 years of her poems, and here's what Billy Collins had to say. Barbara Hamby's poems are wild, outspoken, seriously funny, motor mouth rambles that take us through hoops of association to places both unexpected and unimpeachable. This new and selected offers a generous helping of poems so crackling with references and busy with verbal energy, you might feel them buzzing in your hands. Barbara Hamby.
Thanks so much for having me here. I thought since we were at a library, I would read poems about books and libraries since they've been such a big part of my life. I grew up in a family really that didn't have many books, and so I've been hanging out at libraries my whole life. And I often say that I was raised by George Eliot. I've read Middlemarch every decade, not the first decade of my life, but at the second decade. I think I read it first time when I was 18, and every decade it teaches me something new. But in this new book, in my new poems, there's a poem at the very beginning about um, a a book, The Master and Margarita, which is one of my very favorite books in the whole world. And if you haven't read it, I'm so jealous of you because you have such a delight ahead of you. It's when I try to sum it up, I always say that Satan visits Moscow and all hell breaks loose. He comes with an entourage of a giant cat and a 7-foot-tall carrot top with a broken pair of glasses and a woman who usually appears naked. And it's just a fantastic book. And this poem starts out with that. I love all Russian literature. It's Dostoevsky, The Idiot, is just one of those books, too, that I come back to over and over again. But this is really about reading, and the title is Reading Can Kill You. My husband and I are at a restaurant with another couple, and after a few drinks, the other man and I are talking about how much we love The Master and Margarita, a novel we've both read many times in different translations, but soon it becomes apparent his wife and my husband are stewing, as if Bob and I had discovered we had a former lover in common. Let's say a woman, and we were more passionate about her than our spouses because she was Russian. And instead of no, she said nyet, which sounds like a sexier yes. And yes was da, which is so much more yes than yes, but with a twinge of nyet. And it was winter, a freezing Siberian blizzard with days that began at 10 and ended at 2. And we sat in the dark next to the blazing enamel stove and for breakfast drank tea from the samovar, sweetened with jam, talked about Gogol's sentences and Mandelstam's despair. And then at night it would be love and vodka. So when Satan showed up with his entourage, we were borne along on his cloud of smoke, joining his diabolical magic show, flinging rubles into paradise, cuddling at night with his giant cat, watching the dawn rise, reciting Pushkin and Akhmatova, thrilling to Mayakovsky's rants, and in the white nights of summer, we became poetry. Every breath an iamb, our cries of ecstasy, the nyet that is da. And I can see why my husband is silent and sulky, so I return to our table, sip my Sancerre, talk about Paris, because all four can agree we'd rather be lost in that city than be found in another. And the steps recede, but in the middle of my oysters, I think of my great-grandfather who worked at the mines of Kentucky and one night was supposed to be watching the furnace, but he was reading, and the furnace exploded, killing him, which led my mother to threaten that all my reading would destroy me, too. And I pictured my teenage self in that dank little room, the fire roaring, reading a newspaper, a Union track, Kubla Khan, or maybe Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd, whose heroine, Bathsheba Everdeen, was so rich and beautiful and stupid, I could hardly be blamed for not wanting to be anyone but her. This is actually, in retrospect, a kind of a funny dinner because just after that, the marriage of the other couple just exploded colossally. And so there was something going on there that I guess I intuited, but not what happened. But it's really interesting. When I showed my friend this poem, he said, oh, I really like it. And he thanked me for making the mutual lover a woman. Men. I was looking at the book, and the next poem in the book is really about how books ruined a relationship of mine and an early boyfriend I had who I really liked a lot, and I'll always be grateful to him because he taught me Yiddish. And the way I was introduced to Yiddish, so it was really, that was a nice part of the relationship. But this one, the poem is called $17. That's how much the man who owned DuBay's gave me for my books that time you insisted they were taking up space, and we needed the money. We were poor, sure. You a painter, me a student. But $17. I remember looking at it, a 10, a 5, and two ones, and thinking how little it was compared to the cardboard box you'd lugged into the store that afternoon. All the days and nights those people, Russian aristocrats, English ladies, Southern dingbats, Irish wild men, taught me how to be human. Flawed, yes, but with aspirations of divinity. Where were Prince Mishkin, Dorothea Brooke, Hazel Motes, Stephen Dedalus? We could maybe buy groceries for a week or go to the cafe down the street for dinner or lunch, but how could I get by without my Borges or Wuthering Heights? When I think back on that day, that's when my heart hardened in my chest like a walnut gone bad. So when another man told me he loved me, I looked at him and didn't ask myself, would he love me forever, but would he love my piles of books? When they began to grow by the bed, teeter on every table, and topple to the floor, would his mouth become thin and his voice rise like an accountant's with a ledger? I handed you the money and walked away. You ran to catch up and said, we can take it back. But I felt like the poor mother who had given her child to the rich couple because they can buy her frilly dresses, give her piano lessons, send her to fancy schools. I couldn't take care of my Jane Eyre, my Molly Bloom, Anna Karenina, but maybe someone else could. Now, even now I go to my shelves to look for The Trial or The Day of the Locust or Thus Spake Zarathustra, and when I can't find them, I know they were in that box. What do we do after? Walk home, eat dinner at the cheap Chinese place where you pick the shrimp out of egg rolls and ask, is that pork? It tastes like pork. Later, a French couple bought the building, ripped out the red silk dragons, the lanterns with gold tassels, and turned it into a bistro my new husband and I went to most weekends when we were first married, where I learned to drink wine, eat escargot, and bitter greens. Now it's the parking lot of the federal courthouse, and I can't drink red wine without sneezing. Why did I keep the manifestos of surrealism, which I haven't opened in 30 years? Where are the moviegoer, Nightwood, Tender Buttons, Wise Blood? Years later, both married to other people, you said you were sorry for making me sell those books. We were standing outside your studio in Chicago. It was summer, and you were holding your daughter's hand, and I said it was nothing. But even that day, long ago, I knew it was everything, and it was. Everybody has a lot of pieces of luck in their life, and one of my pieces of luck is that my husband studied when he took French, and I didn't, and I can't speak French at all, or I can buy shoes in French, but he really studied, and so as a result, his French is beautiful, and we've been able to spend a lot of time in Paris, and one time we were living there for about 6 months, and I know no one's going to feel sorry for me, and it was beautiful. I loved it. But at a certain point, I really started missing my own language, just the deep penetration of English. And it was, passing a newsstand and being able to read what was going on in Brittany's life. Or actually, when we were there, it was the Clintons. Clinton was, and Monica Lewinsky, that scandal was had burst upon the scene. The French were just befuddled by the American response. But anyway, I was about 5 months into the trip, I was just missing our English, American English so much, and so this is a poem about that. It started out as an ABCDarian poem, but then I couldn't really make it work, and so I ripped it apart. But you can kind of probably pick out the alphabet as we go through. Ode to American English. I was missing English one day, American really, with its pill-popping Hungarian goulash of everything from Anglo-Saxon to Zulu, because British English is not the same. If the paperback dictionary I bought at Brentano's at the Avenue de l'Opera is any indication, too cultured by half. Oh, the English know their delphiniums, but what about doo-wop, donuts, Dick Tracy, Tricky Dick? With their elegant Oxfordian accents, how could they understand my yearning for the hot rod, hot dog, hot flash vocabulary of the U.S. of A.? the fragmented fandango of Dagwood's everyday flattening of Mr. Beasley on the sidewalk, fetuses floating on billboards, drive-by monster hip-hop stereo shaking the windows of my dining room like a 7.5 earthquake, Ebonics, Spanglish, you know, used as comma and period, the inability of 90% of the population to get the present perfect. I have went, I have saw, I have taken Jesus into my heart. The battle cry of the Bible Belt, but no one uses the King James anymore, only plain speak versions in which Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead says, dude, wake up. And the L man bolts up like a B-movie mummy. Whoa, I was toasted. Yes, ma'am, I miss the mongrel plenitude of American English. It's Fall Guy, Rat Terrier, Dog Pound neologisms, the bomb of it all. The rushing River Jordan backwoods mutability of it, the lowrider boombox cruise of it, from New Jersey to Hawaii with its sly dog malasada scarfing beach blanket lingo to the ubiquitous Valley Girl's like stuttering shopaholic rant. I miss its quotidian beauty, its querulous backbiting righteous indignation, its preening rot-gut flag-waving cowardice. Suffering succotash, sputters Sylvester the cat. Signy die, say the pork-bellied legislators of the swamps and plains. I miss all those guys, their Tweety Bird resilience, their Doris Day optimism, the candid unguent of utter unhappiness on every channel, the midnight televangelist euphoric stew, the junk mail, voicemail vernacular on every boulevard and rue. I miss the Tarzan cry of Johnny Weissmuller, Johnny Cash, Johnny Be Good, and all the smart-talking, gum-snapping, hard-girl dialogue, finger-popping, X-rated street talk, sports babble, Cheetos, Cheerios, chili dog diatribes. Yeah, I miss them all. Sitting here on my sidewalk throne, sipping champagne, verses lined up like hearses, metaphors juking, nouns zipping in my head like Corvettes on Dexedrine, French verbs slitting my throat, yearning for James Dean to junk my curb. Thanks very much.
Such a treat. Okay, Alicia Ostreicher, The Old Woman, The Tulip, and The Dog. Alicia Ostreicher is one of America's premier poets and critics. She's the author of 15 poetry collections, including this brand new book, The Old Woman, The Tulip, and The Dog, poems in the voices of an old woman full of memories, a glamorous tulip, and an earthy dog who always has the last word. So here's what Tony Hoagland had to say. Ostreicher has devised a style that is offhand-seeming, a voice that is effortless, concise, and a subject matter that has leapt past the personal, body, ruthless, insightful, and compassionate. These poems feel like play, even as they take you through configuration after configuration of the mortal condition. Alicia Ostreicher.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. I'm going to start with the first poem in this book, which came to me one night, one of those nights when I can't sleep and I go to my study and sit in front of my laptop and think, well, the blessing of the old woman, the tulip, and the dog. To be blessed, said the old woman, is to live and work so hard, God's love washes right through you like milk through a cow. To be blessed, said the dark red tulip, is to knock their eyes out with the slug of lust implied by your upended skirt. To be blessed, said the dog, is to have a pinch of God inside you, and all the other dogs can smell it. So I thought, well, that's nice, and I'll never write anything like that again. It's completely different from anything else I ever wrote. And so I didn't write anything else like that for about 2 years. And then they started showing up again and wouldn't stop. And I never knew what they were going to say. This one's called The Vow. I must solve my life, said the old woman, thinking of her grandchildren and of her marriage and of her many former lovers. I must solve my life, said the red tulip, arranging her skirts, troubled by the ache of sunshine, the squirrels and dogs, far too hyperactive. I must solve my life, said the dog, torn between tame and wild, bouncing from chow bowl to street, addicted to human love. Dumb animal. Okay, and this one is, deer walk upon our mountains. When they see me, said the old woman, they stop where they are and gaze into my eyes for as long as I am willing to stand there in the wind at the edge of the forest. You are speaking of my mortal enemy, said the dark red tulip. They have eaten many of my family. They do not spare children. They are pests. Beauty excuses nothing. Oh, cried the dog, the very thought of them thrills me to the bone, the chase as much as the capture, the scent weaving ahead of me like a flag, saliva spinning from my teeth. And this one is called Wrong About the Horse. The old woman felt sorry for herself and angry at herself at the same time. Many betrayals had afflicted her. She carried grudges in her throat that paralyzed speech and prevented forgiveness. Unlike you who fear betrayal, I live my whole lifetime in the open air and in the azure present moment, like a butterfly or gnat or horse, said the red tulip. I burden myself with no expectations, therefore I can never be betrayed. Unlike both of you, said the dog, I consider fierce competition essential to life. Among dogs, rivalry is not betrayal. It is energy, leaping and fanged energy that makes a top dog. And you are wrong about the horse. The drink triptych. Well, what can I say, said the old woman, giggling a bit. A glass or three of wine was normal at dinner, but one also enjoyed martinis, gin and tonic to celebrate spring. In summer, rum straight up or margarita, sparkling champagne for especially festive occasions. You see, said the tulip, we who drink nothing but pure rainwater remain awake and alert. Perhaps we shiver and cannot but notice the way you stumble getting home after one of your evenings, scarcely able to find your keys, while we continue upright on the spine of our stems, our petals locked. My long pink tongue, said the dog, is one of my best characteristics. So when I finish my pork chop bone and they put the bowl out, here's how I drink from it. Slurp, slurp, lap, lap. Slurp, slurp, lap, lap. Making a great deal of noise to show my appreciation. So that's like the whole introductory section. This one is called Song. Some claim the origin of song was a war cry. Some say it was a rhyme telling the farmers when to plant and reap. Don't they know the first song was a lullaby pulled from a mother's sleep, said the old woman. A significant factor generating my delight in being alive this springtime is the bird song that, like a sweeping mesh, has captured me like diamond rain. I can't hear it enough, said the tulip. Lifetime after lifetime, we surged up the hill, I and my dear brothers, thirsty for blood, uttering our beautiful songs, said the tulip. Spring is coming, everybody. It is coming. This is anticipating. This one's called April. The optimists among us, taking heart because it is spring, skip along, attending their meetings, signing their email petitions, marching with their satiric signs, singing their Give Peace a Chance songs, posting their rainbow Twitters and blogs, believing in a better world. For no good reason, I envy them, said the old woman. The seasons go round, they go round and around, said the tulip, swaying among her friends in their brown bed in the sun, in the April breeze, under a maple canopy that was also swaying, only with greater motions, casting greater shadows, and the grass hardly stirring. What a concerto of good stinks, said the dog, trotting along Riverside Drive in the early spring afternoon, sniffing this way and that. How gratifying the violins of the river, the tubas of the traffic, the trombones of the leafing elms with the legato of my rivals piss at their feet, and the leftover meat and grease singing along in all the waste baskets. Okay, here's one about perennial grumps. Ridiculous. This is ridiculous, said the literary old woman. Nobody gives us any respect. The young in one another's arms are talking on their iPhones. The congressmen are lying through their teeth, and our husbands are watching the game. This is ridiculous, said the tulip. All those genetically altered blossoms, those stupid, long-lived orchids that are practically plastic, and those fancy designer grasses getting more than market share. This is ridiculous, said the dog. Now they not only have to walk me, they have to rush up after me with their sanitary plastic bags, imposing their bourgeois values on my spontaneous creativity. They speak of race. Honey, I am one gorgeous permanent wave of dune beige, yellow, gold, coal black, European, Asian, African force funneled through centuries of ejaculating ancestors right here to me, said the impure old woman. Of course, as the science of genetics informs us, we hybrids are the ones that survive through the endless brutalities of storm and drought and the rivalry of our peers, said the naturally selected red tulip. Any tribe keep doing the same thing with the same folks, they're going to die out soon. So procreate like me with strangers. Go mix it up. Mongrel is powerful, said the dog. Awakening is a real short one. It can take a lifetime, says the old woman. It can take a single deep kiss, said the tulip. Time to take a nap, says the dog. I want to live. I want to live, said the old woman, like a flame in flight, sky cloudless, visibility unlimited, looking down from a United Airlines window, gin and tonic in hand, at the green and golden graphics of agribusiness wheat, the action painting of the Rockies, the Cartier bling of a nocturnal city, knowing what I know, what everybody knows about my country, the leeches, the worms. Look, I can still shed sparks of pride at its unsurpassed beauty. I want to live a life of passion, said the dark red tulip. You see how hot, how velvety I am. Come a little closer. Do not close your eyes in fear of the moisture in the depths of my well. Do not casually turn away. Here I am in the suburbs, not going anywhere, but look at me. I'm a flame too, and I will perish like a flame. I want to live where I can have it all, said the dog, and that means the Big Apple, the stimulating street life, the nose-enhancing fragrances. Does it surprise you to know my favorite is snow? Though I also like being able to scratch in the dirt and having people ask my owner my name. It flatters my vanity and does good things for my owner's social life. Last poem. Well, in wartime, because it is always wartime. Here you are at last. Sorry about the guards. I hope they didn't give you much trouble. I was afraid you'd never make it across the river before curfew. Let me take your coats, said the old woman. Thank you. How could we possibly pass up such a sweet invitation? But let me tell you, said the tulip, when we reached the bridge, we saw the river was full of corpses. A dog, too, can be afraid, despite an appearance of ferocity. Navigating unfamiliar streets, dodging unpredictable explosions, still one persists in one's errand. Here we are, said the dog. Thank you. I will keep my coat. Thank you.
Thank you, Pitt Poetry Series, Robin Becker, Barbara Hamby, Alicia Ostreicher. Oh, what a wonderful evening. Thanks so much.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.